Our scripture reading, oddly enough, this morning is from Proverbs. And it's Proverbs 5, I think the full chapter, 1 to 23. And I'd like to do something that I don't normally like to do, and that's read it interactively. So I'm going to start, and I'd like you to read the even verses. It's quite lengthy, so let's take our time. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding. For the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. And now, O sons, listen to me, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Lest you give your honor to others and your years to the merciless. And at the end of your life, you groan when your flesh and your body are consumed. I did not listen to the voice of my teachers or incline my ear to my instructors. Drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Let them be for yourself alone and not for the strangers with you. A lovely deer, a graceful doe, let her breasts fill you with all times, with delight, be intoxicated always in her love. For a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. He dies for lack of discipline, and because of his great folly, he is led astray. May God add to the reading of his word and the teaching of our pastor this morning.
Andre Mueller, my best man at my wedding, when he finished his speech, gave me a copy of John Gray's book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. And in chapter 7, John Gray entitled it, Women Are Like Waves. And in this chapter, he goes on to talk about women going down into their well and rising up out of their well. Long before John Gray associated females and water together, the author of Proverbs associated females and water. He calls the young man to be focused and to stay with the cistern or the spring or the well of his youth. These three images of water, the cistern, the spring, or the well, he's referring to his young wife. And ladies, it's important to realize this is to be taken as a compliment. This chapter is not insulting you. It's not derogatory. Remember, as you read through the Old Testament, you'll find that there are situations where sources of water are actually fought over. Conflict. And when you think about it, realize the climate of ancient Israel, and even today. There are portions or sections of that land, because of the way the seasons are, it does not get rain for months. So to have a cistern, which is a collecting holding tank that collects rainwater, to have a well, to have a bubbling spring, a natural spring on your property, these are resources that are highly prized, highly valuable. So to metaphorically reference the wife as these water sources is to esteem the wife. It is to connect her with something that is incredibly precious, even life-saving. But that's the jump into the middle of the chapter. We need to begin at the beginning. Earlier I explained that the book of Proverbs is an anthology of a collection of seven different collections of wise sayings. And we've been basically just looking at some of the teaching from the first collection, chapters 1 through 9. And chapters 1 through 9 is different than the other six collections. Chapters 1 through 9 are these long discourses that are coherent and fit together and flow together. It's very unlike the other collections, which have all these short, pithy little sayings that jump from topic to topic. And in this first collection of these 12 long, cohesive poems, there's 10 lectures. And 10 lectures are given by the father to a son. And it's interesting that if you look at the content of these 10 lectures, an entire 3 of the 10 lectures, chapter 5, chapter 6, verse 20 to 35, and chapter 7, are all about the subject of sexual temptation through the adulteress. So 3 of the 10, 30% of his father's teaching is given over to this topic. The sheer amount of space given to this topic alerts us to something. It alerts us to the fact that this means one of the greatest hazards, one of the greatest challenges and temptations for young people, male or female, are unlawful and immoral sexual experiences. And if they engage themselves in these immoral, unlawful sexual experiences while young, it can ruin them. The context of Proverbs is a father teaching a son. So therefore, it's from the male perspective, told in that perspective, and so the sexual predator is a female adulteress. However, ladies, you can think of this as a mother teaching her daughter, where she's warning the daughter of the smooth-tongued or the slick-tongued adulterer, the male, who is looking to capture and make prey of some young woman. The dynamics, the methods, the consequences of an adulterer or an adulteress, they all and really are the same. The father starts in chapter 5, verse 1. He calls his son with the opening or a standard opening of his lecture. He says, you know, pay attention to my wisdom, obey my teaching, listen up to my instruction. And he gives the purpose in verse 2. He says in verse 1, pay attention to the wisdom, incline your ear to my understanding, so that you may keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. What's that mean? If he's going to keep the instruction of the father, he's going to be able to have his lips guard knowledge, and he's going to be able to keep discretion. What's that mean? Well, I think what it means in the context of the sexual temptation coming in the next verses is that as the son hears the teaching of the father and listens to it, obeys it, puts it to practice in his life, the son is going to be equipped. He's going to have the ability to discern, to have discretion and see through the lies and the flattery of the adulteress. And then the son, if he has heard the father's teaching, he will know the consequences of what's going to happen when you get involved with an adulteress. And so he will speak in response with knowledge, with truth from his lips, turning her down her advancements while he flees. You see, the adulterous woman is going to be giving him a whole different worldview. The adulterous woman is going to be teaching him and enticing him with an entirely different type of lifestyle, contrary to what God has designed. He's going to get a whole other storyline. He's going to get promises that are not real. And in those moments, if the son has kept the wisdom and guarded the wisdom that his father has passed on to him with his lips, and kept discretion, then that shall keep him or guard him in the moment of temptation. It will keep him from falling. Now, from these verses, we arrive at our first insight about dealing with sexual temptation. The first insight is that giving into sexual sin and the suffering, the consequences, does not start with the advances of another. Sometimes we think sexual temptation starts with the flirtation of someone across the table or across the room or on the street. That's not where sexual temptation starts. It starts with abandoning wisdom by not paying attention, not listening to the instruction, the wise teaching, the godly teaching of the Father. And the man who gave into and did and gets involved with the adulteress and suffers the consequences. What does he say later in verses 11 to 13? He says, where did this all begin? It began, as he says, and as he groans at the end of his life, I hated discipline. My heart despised reproof. Verse 13, I did not listen to the voice of my teachers or incline my ear to my instructors. It didn't start with the proposition from the woman, the sexual temptation. His downfall started when he said, I will not listen to the word of the Lord. I will not listen to those who have taught me or who want to teach me the ways of God. So again, this demands that we teach our children, we teach new converts, and we remind those who are already wise of all God's wisdom. And we should be teaching about creation and about sex and about the nature of truth and contentment and money, everything that God has to say. We need to teach those who are wise, those who are new converts, those who are our children. The only way the son is going to avoid the delicious, dripping lips of an adulteress is to know in advance, to have the knowledge in advance of how to see through her lies and see through the flattery. Only then, if he has the knowledge in advance and accepts that and holds true to that, will he be able to escape. This brings us to the lure and the call of the adulteress. It says in verse 3, her lips drip honey. This woman whose lips drip honey, actually, in the Hebrew, the original Hebrew, it means strange woman. That's what she's called. She's called a strange woman. And even though in chapter 5, verse 20, chapter 2, verse 16, chapter 6, verse 24, and chapter 7, verse 5, in English it's translated adulteress, actually the Hebrew word means foreign woman. So she's described as a strange woman, a foreign woman. What does that mean? It does not mean that it's referring to someone who's a non-Jewish woman. You got a Jewish father speaking to a Jewish son. He's not saying the other nations' ladies, they drip honey from their lips. They're the ones who are going to entice you. No, that's not what he's saying. The strangeness, the foreignness, is not about ethnicity. It's that she operates outside the normal, moral, legal, and godly ways of marriage and sexual boundaries that God has set up. She's strange. She's foreign in that she does not walk in the paths of God. She does not live according to the design of God regarding human life and sexuality and marriage. She's foreign to the ways of God. Chapter 2, verse 17 describes her as forsaking the companion or the husband of her youth and not listening to God, rejecting covenant with God. So she's foreign to the ways of God. That's why she's called a foreign woman or she's called a strange woman. She's rejected those. In the other speeches, in chapter 6 and chapter 7, she is described as being married. Therefore, yes, ultimately we are talking about an adulteress here in chapter 5, even though that's not mentioned as a term in the Hebrew. Two things to note about the adulteress tactics. First of all is the use of her speech. It says that her lips drip honey and her palate, that's the inner part of your mouth. You take your tongue and rub the top of your mouth. It's very smooth. So it's saying that her lips drip honey and the inside of her mouth is smooth as oil. These are sensuous images. These are two heads locked together, lips locked, tongues going together. They're passionate. This is the picture here. This is the imagery. Honey is to be licked. Honey is to be tasted. So there's a great metaphor going on for entwined mouths here. However, there's the smoothness imagery, and it represents and includes flattery as well. Not just the sensual, sexual image, but the flattery, where she's using her lips to appeal to the man through her speech, through flattering him, through stroking his ego, through calming, giving him calming words to remove his inhibitions and his concerns. Don't worry, honey, everything's all right. I got it all worked out for you. Chapter 7, verse 21 says this, with much seductive speech, she persuades him with her smooth talk. She compels him. The second thing to note about her talk and her speech is that it's all a mirage. It seems, well, her talk is a dream that will become a nightmare. It's not real. She drips sweetness, but in the end, the father says she's bitter. She's smooth. But yeah, she's smooth, but also sharp as a two-edged sword. The two-edged sword doesn't do really much good for helping me understand because we don't use swords today. She's smooth, but sharp as a razor blade. And all guys here know you don't tangle with a razor blade. You don't hug and get close, and you definitely don't put your tongue to a razor blade. Any involvement with her turns sour and it brings death. And so the picture here is of men engaging the mouth of the adulteress, expecting tremendous passion and pleasure and sensual pleasure, but only as they engage her mouth, they find out it's cruel. To their terror, it is cruel. And her mouth, like a horror movie, kissing a monster, all of a sudden he thinks he's kissing a beautiful woman, but then her mouth opens wide and devours him, bites off his head like the female praying mantis does to its mate. This is the adulteress. And the father knows this. This is the true nature of the adulteress. So he goes on in verses 7 to 14 to describe the after effects of what happens when you get involved with an adulteress. He sums them up, three costs. One, wasted physical labor and health. B, economic depletion. C, or third, social degradation or social demise. In Proverbs chapter 6, verses 30 to 31, it talks about a thief. A thief who is stolen because he is hungry. And it says in Proverbs 6, 30 to 31, that nobody will despise the thief who's stolen because he's hungry. They understand why he did it. He was hungry. But he shall still pay back seven times. He shall make restitution for what he has stolen. It goes on to talk about the man who has entered another man's wife, who has stolen and had sex with another man's wife. Verses 33 to 35 of chapter 6 states that man, he will receive wounds. He will receive dishonor. He will face a jealous husband who, in revenge and anger in those days, probably wants and perhaps received the slavery of the other man and the utter financial ruin of the other man. It says that even though the other man, or the man who committed adultery with his wife, even though he gives the man many gifts, he's not going to be satisfied. And then you have the whole other angle, the woman who seduced the young man. She might start to begin to demand ongoing payments for her silence. Well, if you don't want me to tell anybody about our little episodes, maybe you better increase your gifts to me monthly, weekly. And so these verses are describing how one's strength, one's work, one's energy is going to these payoffs, and it's impoverishing their life and their health just because they got involved in a few moments of foolishness. Paul Coptic writes, "The poetic justice at work shows that in going after a strange woman, one that is not his own, the son could lose all that is his own to strangers." That's what occurs when we get involved in sexual immorality. Further, verse 14 reveals that what is done in secret is not going to stay secret. These types of things are done alone, off, in hidden corners and hidden rooms, and in the nighttime. But it's going to be spread all around the community, a reputation and family honor ruined. But did you notice in verse 9 that the youth gives this up willingly? He gives up his health, his money, his life, his honor. Such a contrast to what we saw in chapter 1. Remember the gang in chapter 1, verses 11 to 14? The murderous gang, the thieving gang, they forcibly take from their victim their possessions, their life. But here, the one who gets involved with the adulteress or an adulterer, they willingly are giving over their life. They're willingly giving their money. They're willingly giving over their reputation to be ruined and destroyed. These losses are the opposite of what wisdom rewards. If you look in verse 16 of chapter 3, if we embrace wisdom, it brings us long life. It brings us wealth or riches and honor. But this kind of foolishness, as illustrated in chapter 5, what does it bring? It brings poverty, it brings shame, it brings ill health, accumulating in death. Now, the father is warned, the son, against the foolishness of getting involved with an adulteress. He's warned by telling about the consequences. Son, if you get involved with these ladies, this is what's going to happen to you. Now he switches tactics. Now he tries a different approach, and he encourages the son. He says, this is the right way to go. This is the proper way to go. And he encourages the son to walk in the way of wisdom regarding sex. And in verses 15 to 20, the way of wisdom for the son is simply intoxicating, delightful, but monogamous sex with his own spouse. So now, in addition to keeping attentive to the Father's teaching, verse 1, by keeping far from the woman who is the source of attention, verse 8, now in these verses, he presents a third defense against the adulteress. He says, "Son, expend your sexual energy with the wife of your youth. Both of you, expend your passion on each other. Engage your sexual energy with each other in a vibrant, satisfying, mutual sexual relationship. Go to it, son. Get hot and heavy under those sheets with your wife." See, I knew if I put it that way, you'll get it. The water stuff, let me explain it. The water, it's acceptable erotic imagery from the ancient Middle East. He calls or tells his son, he says, "Your wife is a cistern. It's a well. She's a fountain," or fountain's better translated, spring. And he says, "Drink of her. Fill yourself up with her." And what he's saying, using these euphemisms, is have sex with your wife. So expend your passion and your sexual desire on her. And she will quench your sexual passion. Just like water quenches your thirst in the desert or on a hot day. The son's sexual energy is described in verses 16 to 17. As springs and streams of water, which he says, don't scatter your sexual energy all over the town square with these foreign women. Keep that for yourself and for your own wife. It's yours alone. Exclusively given. Your own passion, son, is to be given, and your own body is to be given to your wife. And you refresh your wife with your water. And she does likewise. Don't give your passion to strange women. So the sexual satisfying, the drinking of each other's water is a mutual thing that goes on between the son and the wife. And in verses 18 to 19, the father pronounces a blessing on the sexual relations of his son and his daughter-in-law. Using ancient cultural euphemisms, where certain animals are associated with aspects of love and sexual attraction, he desires his son to be blessed. So he says, he blesses his son. May you always be delighted with your wife's breasts or his daughter-in-law's breasts. He's be intoxicated by them, son. Don't get other women's breasts to intoxicate you. May it just be your wife's. May they fill your vision. Now, one thing that arises in application from this part of the passage and this positive description of sex and marriage is that sex is a divine gift. It's to be received and enjoyed in the proper context of a heterosexual marriage. Yes, it's true. God forbids all other kinds of sexual activity outside of this heterosexual marriage between a man and a woman who are married to each other. God has not designed and not given sex to humans to engage in however we please. We're humans, not dogs. However, the delights of engaging in sex, while it is given only to a man and woman who are married to each other, and while that eliminates every other kind of form of sex that is being practiced in our society today, we must remember against those prohibitions. We must not lose sight of the fact that the church must promote the fact that sex in marriage is a joyful, wonderful, intoxicating thing that our children should be taught, and new believers and converts should be taught, and the wise already should be reminded of this. This text teaches that sex is a gift of pleasure to be enjoyed by a man and a woman who are married to each other. Sex is not just merely for procreation. It's not just, oh, God designed it so that, okay, yeah, we gotta, you know, somehow we gotta keep propagating the species. Think about it. If sex was just for propagating the species, he could have designed it very simply where, you know, some little growth comes off our side and it pops off at a certain side and you get a 5-inch little man or woman and they start growing. Why did he design all the pleasure? Why did he put all the different erogenous zones on our body? It's a gift. It's a gift. So often the church, and thus by association, God is viewed as anti-sex. The reality is, God designed sex to be enjoyed, to be pleasurable, to be delightful for a man and a woman who are married to each other for life. And I think that's a message we have forgotten to tell our kids and to tell each other. It is a scriptural message. Paul Coptic puts it well. The admonition to rejoice in the wife of one's youth speaks to the fact the power of eros, eros means sexual love, can drive in two directions. It can lead toward or away from lifelong commitment. The discipline of saying no to inappropriate desire, then, should find its counterpart in saying yes to building a strong marriage. Eros alone is not enough to keep a relationship together, but wisdom in its reflective and loving capacity can. The church needs to explain how saying no to that which is out of bounds is not an end in itself, but a way to saying yes to God's gift of sexual pleasure. End of quote. Yes, we need to remember sex is not the end-all, the be-all for a marriage. That's a Hollywood version. It's a mirage. Sex is not the glue of marriage. Sex is not our identity. But a proper understanding of an proper appreciation for and an enthusiastic participation of sex by a married couple as God's design and gift does sweeten, it does bring life to, and it does protect the marriage. So if we put it and keep it in its proper place, it brings life. Take sex and put it outside the boundaries and the design that God has for it, it brings ruin, all kinds of ruin. So the father ends this section of positive encouragement with a question in verse 20. He says to the son, in light of the warm, loving sexual relationship with your wife, why embrace the strange, calculating, adulteress of death? Look at the difference, son. Look at the difference of these two paths. These two different ways of life. Look at the way of sexual foolishness and the way of sexual wisdom. However, he still has one more point to make. If the son hasn't made up his mind through the comparison of the negative consequences and the positive encouragement, he pulls out one more final ultimate reason why he should stay away from the adulteress, and that is in verse 21, for a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his path. In other words, the ultimate reason is everybody is living before an omniscient God. Omniscient means knows everything. And we live not just before an omniscient God, we also live before a just God, a God of justice. And this God who knows everything upholds the moral order and design he has declared as real and right. And he will hold everyone account. And the truth is he knows everything we've done. Everything that was done in secret. Every adulterous relationship and act, he knows, he sees it. The interesting thing here is in this verse, and following to the end of the chapter, verse 22 and verse 21, the plural. So he is observing a man's ways, plural, and then iniquities. It means all of our ways, not just a case of adultery, but all our iniquities are before God. He sees every act. He sees every, he knows every motive. He knows every thought, every emotion felt. No sin of any time or any place escapes his gaze. Bruce Waltke makes this interesting point. Though God knows all this and he sees all this going on, he doesn't send a lightning bolt to turn the people to ash. Instead, what happens in these verses? It says, the iniquities of the wicked ensnare him, and he is held fast in the cords of his sin. In other words, justice comes by God just letting people have their own way. The natural consequence of not holding to the teaching of wisdom and rejecting the source of life, God, is to embrace the source of death. That's what naturally comes when we turn from God. So he just has to let nature, so to speak, take its course, and the sin itself will entangle and strangle and bring a person to death. So to reject God and his design for our life and live how we want is to walk away from the one sure source of and guide to our life, God, and to embrace our own self-destruction. That's the difference between the path of wisdom and the path of foolishness. But things need not end in death. Things not need end in destruction. The way of wisdom has been given to us. It has been taught to us by God. God has given us his wisdom, his knowledge of how he designed things, how he wants us and expects us to live. He's given us a way of goodness, a way of righteousness, a way of forgiveness, a way of reconciliation in Jesus Christ. But like chapter 5, verse 1 says, we need to be attentive to the teaching. We need to incline our ear to what God has said. We need to embrace it. We need to act on it. Obeying what he taught, walking with God himself in the way of wisdom. Forgiveness and the path of wisdom is still available to all in Jesus Christ, even for the adulterer, even for the adulteress. As Jesus made clear in his encounter with the woman at the well. This morning, rather than a congregational song of response, the music committee has planned for a special song to be sung. It's called All I Have Ever Done, and it reflects on the woman, the Samaritan woman, who had several husbands and was the woman, or the man she was living with when she met Jesus, wasn't her husband. It reflects on her encounter with Jesus from John chapter 4. I ask you guys to come and do that. Following the benediction, we will have the Swensons video, Christmas video. And if you haven't seen it, you're welcome to stay behind and watch it. It's about 8 minutes long. Please rise for the benediction. These are the words that God has given to us. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For God will judge the sexually immoral and the adulterous. Keep your life free from love of money, and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. Do not be led away by diverse and strange teachings. May the Word of God be a light to your feet and a lamp to your path. Amen. Please be seated.